Chairs No Waiting, episode number 697, The Riders. Two Chairs No Waiting is brought to you each week by the folks over at WeaversDepartmentStore.com. Drop by over at Weavers and check out the brand new tea towel. It's a Mayberry tea towel. That's right, Miss Weaver has had the Mayberry tea towels created. So go check it out. There's all kinds of Mayberry-related items on that towel. I think you'll enjoy hanging it in your kitchen or wherever you might like to. While you're over there, check out Becoming Thelma Lou. It's on pre-order. Go ahead and order yours now. It's a great book by Betty Lynn, all about her. So head over to WeaversDepartmentStore.com and check it out. Hello, everybody. I'm Alan Newsom, your host. And I also want to thank our executive producer for episode number 696, Lynn Thomas. So, Lynn, thank you from my heart to your heart. That's my heart speaking to your heart. Again, I'm Alan Newsom, the host of Two Chairs No Waiting. It's always fun to spend time here with you and just talk about the Andy Griffith Show, Mayberry, all the things that just make it special. Well, this episode is going to be called, it's about the writers. So the writers of the Andy Griffith Show, they don't get as mentioned as much as the actors, but it is they who created the characters, the Andy and Don and all the cast were able to bring to life. But without those writers, we wouldn't have stories about, you know, baby birds losing their mama, about unusual mountain folks. There's several on the Andy Griffith Show we could talk about from that. And the other special folks that that live in Mayberry. It was the writers who created the world in which Barney and Andy lived and helped to make it come to life, because their words were the things that those actors took and created a what is almost real to me, and probably to you too, the real world of Mayberry, North Carolina. There's this out of print book that has been out of print for quite a while, and it's called Inside Mayberry, the Andy Griffith Show Handbook. I have a copy right here in my hands that I have been marking things in for a long time. But it's a book by Dan Harrison and Bill Habib that's been out of print for I don't even know how many years now. But I have a copy, and I use it from time to time because it's just got some fun things in there that I think we would enjoy here on the show. And there's a chapter on the writers, and that's the reason I named the podcast The Writers. I'm going to share some of the insights that Harrison and Habib divined in their chapter about the writers in that book. And I'll be doing some reading. So hopefully the story that I'm going to tell you is good enough that you won't mind the fact that I'm reading to you. That's not something I enjoy doing. I don't tend to just read, you know, this is a little bit different. So I think we're going to play a little background music for you. That's just, I don't know. How about this one? That sounds Mayberry-ish. And I have a cough drop in my mouth. So if you're hearing a little rattling on my teeth, that's what it is. So folks, we're going to read this neat story about the writers of the Andy Griffith Show. And I hope you're going to enjoy it. If you're watching the video version, I'm going to try to show you a little video over my head as we talk about it, just to give you something to look at. So the writers, they were the best, Aaron Rubin said, of the more than 50 writers who contributed to the Andy Griffith Show. We did 30 shows every season, 30. When you ask, how can you do so many? The answer is the writers. Jack Ellison and Charles Stewart were the writing team responsible for the first three episodes, 14 of the first 32, and 29 of the first 64 episodes of the Andy Griffith Show. Don Knotts said, they were the guys who came up with a lot of the running gags, the one bullet thing, getting locked in the cells. Those were their ideas. The balance of the first 64 were written by a combination of individuals that include Harvey Bullock and the writing team of Jim Fritzell and Everett Greenbaum. When the show moved into the third and fourth seasons, these writers, along with the writing teams of Bill Ellison and Sam Broderick, would be responsible for 48, that's 75% of the 64 episodes that aired. So that, those first several years, that's amazing. Of the remaining 16, six were written by producer Aaron Rubin, eight by John Wheaton, and one by Sid Morris, and the writing team of Bill Freeman and Harry Sharp. Already a veteran of six episodes, including The Pickle Story, Andy and Barney in the Big City, and The Bookie Barber, Harvey Bullitt began his second season as a writer for The Andy Griffith Show in the program's third season. So it was in his third season when he was writing this. As a writer for, he wrote the episode, it's number 66, by the way, the Mayberry classic, Mr. McBeavy. Harvey said, "I like that one. I like writing for old guys, and that one was dandy." Named after the central character, Mr. McBeavy told the story of Opie's fascination with a fanciful telephone lineman played by Charles Swenson. The heart of the story revolved around Andy's assumption that Mr. McBeavy was a character fabricated from his son's imagination. When Opie comes home with money, he claims Mr. McBeavy gave it to him, and Andy is faced with a problem of forcing Opie to admit that his friend is fictitious. Bullock recalled, "That story came from one of the seminars. Originally, the idea was a story in which the father has trouble accepting that his child is what his child is saying." And Aaron said, "We're going to have to give Andy or have Andy straighten the kid out." I remember it suddenly rose up in me and I said, no, that's not the way to go. The way to go is the father is going to have to grasp that there are times when he has to accept the unacceptable. Sometimes he has to give some breathing space." And Sheldon Leonard said, "Bingo." That was the turnaround that they were looking for. That's how I got the story. That's all from Harvey Bullock. The seminars that Bullock was referring to were another innovation of Sheldon Leonard. Sheldon said this. He said, "When I was directing and producing, which is what happened in the third year of the Danny Thomas Show, I knew that my responsibility was to accumulate stories. In those days, we did 39 episodes a year, as opposed to the 22 they do now. I had to get the stories, and I couldn't do it when we were in production because we would be on stage most of the time directing. So I would invite my core writers to be my guest in Las Vegas when Danny Thomas was working in the Sands Hotel, and the Sands would pick up the bill. We'd go over there for a week, and we'd set on the patios of the various cottages in Las Vegas, and we'd pitch ideas. How would it be if Danny did this, and his wife did that, and so on? Now, we'd do this for a week. In that week, we'd generate ideas, and the secretary would make notes about them. We'd have four or five writing combinations there, some singles, some teams. None of them knew who was going to get what. But by that point, they had all made a rich contribution to all of them. When we had accumulated enough, I'd start handing them out." That's Sheldon Leonard talking. After Leonard branched out with the Andy Griffith Show, the trips to Vegas ended. But the idea of the seminar remained a viable one. Aaron Rubin recounted how they were organized. So Aaron said, "Toward the end of the season, when it was a foregone conclusion that we were getting picked up, Sheldon would call together a meeting in his office of some nine or so writers. We would all pitch in on story ideas. How about Aunt B makes awful pickles that she decides to enter into a contest? How about Barney decides, you know, whatever?" I would sit there scribbling really fast as everyone chimed in. Then, as best I could, I would write a brief outline. We'd distribute them to the writers, And the next day, we'd have them have another group of writers come in, and we'd start all over. The result of all this work was a head start on scripts for the upcoming season. It wasn't easy. Reuben went on to say, if a couple of stories from each group was good, we felt fortunate. But by the time we finished these seminars, we'd have 8 or 10 assignments to give out. Guys could go off by themselves and work. And now the season is over, and they're already beginning their first drafts. As practical as it may seem, the seminar is now part of television history. It's quite illegal now, stated Everett Greenbaum. It's against writer's golden rule. It would be considered working for nothing, and I kind of enjoyed the seminars. That was Everett Greenbaum. Greenbaum was not the only one who loved the seminars. Harvey Bullock, another seminar regular, told his version of one of the lighter moments from those sessions. One story I remember involved Freddie Fox, who sometimes worked with a guy named Izzy Ellison. Freddie stammers, and he has the classic stammer, and made more jokes about it than anyone. Well, after we'd come up with a good notion, and they had made a list, on the last day they'd hand them out, and everybody liked the pickle story. Now, it's the end of the week, and everybody's supposed to ask for stories that they want. Well, Freddie was one of the most affable, outgoing guys imaginable, a charitable to the fault person. He wanted that story. So Sheldon brings it up. Who wants a pickle story? He says, is what Sheldon said. Freddie can't find his voice. He looks at Izzy because he's helpless. He's hung up, you know, from the stuttering. He's hung up. He's trying to find some help, and he wants to bid on it. But Izzy is busy writing notes. So Sheldon says, Harvey, you take that one. Freddie says, for Christ's sake, Izzy, you just blew the pickle story. The stories that were assigned in the seminars were not fully fleshed out. After writers got their assignments, there was still much work to be done. Harvey Bullock says, we'd leave with 2 or 3 stories. We'd write up a step outline. We'd bring it to Aaron Reuben, and he'd give it to you, or he'd either give you the okay or suggest some changes. That's when you catch the problem stuff. When you'd leave to do the regular routine, you'd do the first draft and get it to them, and then they'd call you back for changes again, and then you'd come, and then would come the most wonderful words of all. We're going into Mimeo with it. That meant your script was approved. They were going to print it and hand it over to the cast. That was an epiphany. From the point the scripts went to Mimeo, it was no longer in the writer's hands. The producers, the directors, the actors started to work on the script. The practice we had back then, according to Aaron Reuben, was to read 2 scripts on a Thursday morning. One was in an advanced script. Wow. So if there was anything that was wrong with it, it could be fixed. So you'd read a script that's coming up in the next few weeks. So you'd read that, and so they could fix it. And that would be the script that would be going into production the following week. The second script we would read was a script for the current week that had been already fixed and was ready for rehearsal. During these sessions, known as table reading, the actors were given an opportunity to suggest changes. If something did not appeal to someone, or if there was an idea that maybe they thought would work better, the comments were considered and often accommodated. The table readings were so much fun because everyone had input, said Anita Corso. That's Miss Crump, if you don't remember. Corso's favorite table reading story involved Rosemary Dorsey, the show's script lady. I adore comedy writers. Anita said, but sometimes they can just overthink things. We were reading, it was episode number 168, The Hollywood Party, and Andy was sitting on a sofa in the starlet's dressing room and getting uncomfortable. So he makes a comment on the drapes saying, gee, these are pretty drapes. What color would you call that? They were all looking for a funny color. It was the odd thing that some number and some words were intrinsically funny. And they were going back and forth, coming up with nothing. There was a long silence, and Rosemary said, brown. Well, we were glad to get the actor's input, Reuben said. Although once, I remember one of the actors got a little out of hand, and Sheldon Leonard said, I believe I have to warn you, this is not a democracy. What we have here is a benevolent dictatorship. Through the seminars, even though they were helpful in getting a head start on the new season, they still left more than half the scripts to be written. The writers themselves were left to invent stories for those. Harvey Bullock said, I always worshipped story and was in awe of people who knew them. They're hard to come by. They involve a lot of ceiling staring. I love Harvey. Everett Greenbaum said, the one story that really got us stuck for an ending was episode number 112, Barney Sidecar. We didn't know how to get out of that one. But I had just bought a little tool for burning wood into wood. So I said to Jim Fritzell, why don't we just put a sign in there and then up earlier we'll have Opie playing with this thing. It was such a phony thing, but it was all we could think of, and well, I guess it worked. So Opie Burning, his name just came from that story. That's cool. In episode number 143, it was Barney's Fife Realtor, written by Bill Ellison and Sam Broderick. It was another example of writers drawing from his own life. Ellison says, the great thing about being a writer is nothing bad can happen to you. If you can turn it into a story, if you can do that, then every experience you ever have turns into cash. I love that. At one time, I wrote a skit for the Writers Guild Awards show. I just left a real estate business, and I sat down and described and decided that I was going to be a writer. I was in my late 30s, and I sold my first script to the Twilight Zone. And by the way, it won the Writers Guild Award. I used to call people on the phone, and I had a reverse directory, and I'd ask, would you like to sell your house? I'd usually get a woman during the day, and the answer was always, well, we've thought about it. I was amused. Everybody I talked to was interested in selling their house. They'd say, well, if we could get more room or bigger closets or smaller this or that. So I got this idea that Barney gets everyone interested in selling their house, but everything is contingent on getting the other guy's house. And of course, no one ever moves. Oddly enough, the writing team of Jim Fritzell and Everett Greenbaum began their career with no background in the craft of writing. They managed, however, to produce some of television's finest moments. Greenbaum said, I never had any courses in writing. I went to MIT, but I flunked out because I wasn't good enough at math. Jim was completely uneducated. Jim's talent was on the penthouse level, but his taste was definitely on the ground floor. He would turn on the quiz shows and watch them all day. He was addicted to sports. He knew everyone's batting average and so forth, but when we were working, he could produce all kinds of wonderful stuff. They used to have a ball riding together, said Anita Corso. I had a wonderful pleasure of riding with Jim on a show called Anna and the King. We wrote two or three of them together, and he taught me their approach to construction, about how the building a story. He taught him all that. Corso was Andy's girlfriend on the show, Miss Crump. She was Jim Fritzell's girlfriend off the set in real life. Jim was so outgoing, Corso remembered. He absolutely loved everyone who met Jim. And everyone who met Jim loved him. He was funny. He was loving. He was attractive. I don't know if he was good looking or not, but he was beautiful. Jim and Ev were both from the big city, Corso recalls, but still they wrote such wonderful rural stories. It was strange, but when you look at the other side of that, Damon Raymond, who had a rural background, became known as the New York writer. I think the good part of that has to do with being an outsider looking in. When you're so close to something, it's difficult to see things in a fresh way. It becomes so normal that it's hard to see the qualities that make the people and places special. The Andy Griffith Show writers received inspiration from the most memorable work from a variety of sources. Their backgrounds gave a wealth of knowledge from which they each drew. Everett Greenbaum provided some examples. He said, in episode number 112, Barney's Sidecar, Barney gave his memorable speech that followed Andy's refusal to let him use the squad car to patrol Highway 6. Greenbaum, who wrote that episode, said Fritzell recalled the origin of the payoff line in that speech. Barney gets upset and goes on about how it's the same the world over. Police departments with the lowest paid underdog officials of them all. They're the lowest paid. And then he sums it up by saying, but it's thank you, Johnny Sappho, when the guns begin to shoot. That's Kipling, and it's from Gunga Din. The motorcycle itself was another bit from history that of Greenbaum's past. I had a World War I Harley Davidson when I was a kid. I paid $8 for it, and I was young, a young boy, so my father had a tire supply store, and he had a motorcycle with a sidecar that two of the men who worked for him had, Howard and Eddie Ziffel. They used to go out in it when they were bill collecting. So that's where the sidecar came from. Oh my goodness. Another Greenbaum and Fritzell script borrowed from one of the masters to give Barney one of his most quotable lines. In episode 93, Dogs, 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 after Barney goes out to rescue stray dogs from dangers of breaking thunderstorms, bringing them back at the risk of losing a much wanted extra funds, Andy congratulates the deputy on his good deed. Barney's eloquent response, the quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as a gentle rain from heaven. This catches Andy by surprise. That's Shakespeare, Greenbaum admitted, and it's from The Merchant of Venice. So Barney's quoting Shakespeare. Friends, this is a lot longer story. I don't want to keep reading it all to you, but I'm hoping you're enjoying some of these insights that we've got. And I think I'll try to pick up on this and maybe finish reading some of this to you. Let me finish out this one part here. So he's talking about The Merchant of Venice. Greenbaum did not just draw from the classics. He credits Aaron Rubin with creating the giraffe speech. You remember that one? Which occurs during Dogs, Dogs, Dogs. Barney and Opie were releasing some stray dogs in the field, and it starts to rain, and Opie's concerned about the animals. We all know this story because they're loose in the storm. Barney explains how the dogs will handle the storm in a way that other animals couldn't. Greenbaum continues. Barney gets on the giraffes and turns on them because they're selfish. They run around looking out for number one, getting struck by lightning. That was Aaron Rubin's idea. I remember it clearly because I liked it so much. Aaron Rubin, however, avoided taking credit for this contribution to the show. Aaron said, I don't know why they always want to give me credit for that, Rubin says. They really liked that line. Why? I don't know. Greenbaum's words It was a small thing, but it really made the whole scene work. So there you go. So guys, I may come back to this and finish out this story in the coming weeks if you guys are enjoying this. But I think it's pretty amazing hearing from the writers of the Andy Griffith Show directly, and just some of the stories that they actually have related to how they came up with these amazing stories. There's not too terrible much left, but if you guys are enjoying that, let me know. And maybe I'll finish that up in a second episode about the writers from the Andy Griffith Show. All right. So while we are here, we're going to play a little bit of Mayberry trivia, and then we'll let you guys head out of here. I hope you guys are enjoying all this stuff. So let's get our trivia music going. There we go. Trivia music. All right. If you guys are ready, I am. Question number one, the mayor shook Barney's hand for ticketing the governor's car. True or false? The mayor shook Barney's hand for ticketing the governor's car. True or false? The answer, that's false. That is false. He did not do that. I was really enjoying that story, by the way. I'm interested now in finishing that up. So I hope you guys like it. Send me an email at floyd@imayberry.com and let me know if you enjoyed the story about the writers, and I'll finish it up for you. This is a neat book. It's been out of print for a long time, so a lot of you don't have access to it. But it's called Inside Mayberry, the Andy Griffith Show Handbook. So see if you can find you a copy. Question number two. Why did the governor come to see Barney? Why did the governor come to see Barney? Chat room's doing pretty good. Why did the governor come to see Barney? He came to shake his hand. To shake his hand, that was why he came. All right. All right, number three. All right, so I don't know if you guys will get this or not. What was Barney's home address? What was Barney's home address? Let's see. Can you get it? Why or what was Barney's home address? I'm heading out Route 1. The owner of the still is Barney Fife. That's one time we hear it. Where did he live? 411 Elm Street. The owner of the still is Barney Fife. Otis did that, remember? All right, number four. Barney said, the blank keep their farm better than anyone. Barney said, the blank keep their farm better than anyone. Okay, I'll give you multiple choice on this one. Barney said the blank keep their farm better than anyone. Was it the Smiths, the Carters, the Johnsons, or the Boones? Barney said the blank keep their farm up better than anyone. The answer is the Johnsons. I think a Johnson farm's a picture no artist could draw. Let's see if I gave that a right. All right, so Johnson's was correct. Number five. This is true or false question. Opie and Arnold convinced a bank robber to confess. Opie and Arnold convinced a bank robber to confess. True or false? True or false? Opie and Arnold convinced a bank robber to confess. The answer is that's true. That's true. Now, that's a color episode, so I don't know how you did, but that's a true answer. All right. Who said, you just go up an alley and holler fish? I can't believe too many of you are going to miss this one. Who said, you just go up an alley and holler fish? Very hard not to try to read it in the voice. Last read. Okay. You know who said it? Who said, you just go up an alley and holler fish? This is Gomer. Well, you just go up an alley and holler fish. Yep. All right. It was Gomer. Now, that was when he was getting citizen's arrest. That one. Okay. All right. Number seven. On what highway did Barney set up his speed trap? On what highway did Barney set up his speed trap? This is pretty hard, I think. This is Checkpoint Chicky, by the way, so that helps. On what highway did Barney set up his speed trap? The chat room's getting it. The answer is Highway 6. It was Highway 6. All right, our last question. Last question. Checkpoint Chicky is Barney's what? Checkpoint Chicky is Barney's what? This is actually a truth. No, it's actually Highway 6. So at least that's what it says in here. All right. Checkpoint Chicky is Barney's what? It's a multiple choice, so I'll give you the multiple choices. Is it his Checkpoint Chicky is Barney's girlfriend, his driving test, his nickname, or his speed trap? His speed trap is the correct answer. Speed trap. So welcome to Checkpoint Chicky. There you go. So it was his speed trap. How did you do, guys? How did you do? Hope you did well. Hope you did well. Thank you to the VW Boys for that background music. Folks, I got something else I'll tell you about. So if you're on Facebook and you follow me over there, I found over the weekend, I found a picture that I'm going to show on the video version. And it's already posted over on Facebook and it'll be posted in the podcast notes. But we found a picture of Henry Bennett. Now, folks, you may or may not have heard about the Maine Oak Emporium in Mount Airy, North Carolina. If you ever travel to Mount Airy for Mayberry Days and things like that, the building had an issue the day after the 4th of July. So I found this picture that shows on the 4th of July, it shows Henry Bennett himself leaning against the Maine Oak Emporium. The building looks pristine. It looks beautiful. The green painted brick with the sign Maine Oak Building right there, right on Main Street in Mount Airy, North Carolina. And then during the night, the evening of the 4th of July, beginning the morning hours, early morning hours of July the 5th, well, the building facade began to crumble, at least on the third floor. And I found a photo of Henry standing, looking up at the collapsing building. So Henry Bennett, the Mayberry Jinx, may or may not have had something to do with the Maine Oak Emporium having issues. So if you'd like to see this picture, which is pretty fun, head over. It'll be on Facebook, for this week's podcast episode. I'll upload it there so you guys will be able to see it. All right, guys, that is, I think, all I have for us for this episode. I want to thank you for being here with me. It's always fun to spend time in Mayberry. I hope you are enjoying that. I know I was reading a lot tonight. I really got into reading the story. I was enjoying myself. So hopefully you enjoyed it as well. We've got a lot of fun. Hey, if you're going to be in the Troy, Ohio area on Friday, the 12th of August, 2022, come out and see us. We're going to be showing the Mayberry Man movie. We're doing a show before that with Baraka Valley and the Mayberry Tribute Artist. So come out to Troy, Ohio on Friday and come and see us. If you don't get it this week, it's already happened, so you'll just have to wait. But we're looking forward to seeing some of you. I'd love to hear from you. Give me a call at 888-68, whatever our number is, and come out and see us. How did I forget that? I have to play the music again because I forgot my phone number. It's 888-684-8415. Give us a call and come out and see us. Let's play some more closing music. I'd love to see you. I hope you get to make it out and give me a call. You can also email me at floyd@imayberry.com. Love to hear from you. It's always fun to have just Mayberry folks in my life and sharing the love. If you enjoyed this week's podcast, I need to hear from you because I'll finish that up if you'd like for me to give you a little more information from the writers which I think is very interesting. The writers of the Andy Griffith Show are responsible for so much of what we actually see during the show. The actors are amazing, but they need those words and ideas to actually act out. So great story. So folks, have a great Mayberry week, and we'll see you next time right here on Two Chairs. Bye, everybody.